client comes in and tells a story, the first thing you're going to have to decide, of course, you don't have to decide for this exam, you're going to have to decide, is my client talking about something that has to do with contracts or torts or property law or constitutional law, or what is it about? That's the one thing I'll tell you. I'll give you this one. The answer to that question is contracts, okay, for this exam. So having said that, what are you going to listen for? Well, I'm going to listen for whether or not there was an enforceable contract to begin with. And in order to think about that, I'm going to think about whether or not there was mutual assent at some point or another, and whether there's consideration. And then click over, if it's one of those contracts that would fall within the statute of frauds where writing is required, then I also have to add to my list of must-haves, I'm going to include a writing. So then I must have consideration, I must have mutual assent, and maybe I must have writing depending upon the subject matter of the contract. And then from there I probably start frankly with agreement, not with consideration. And I'd say, do I think there's mutual assent? Do I think there's mutual assent? And so in order to do that, I have two things to think about. One is the mechanics of offer and acceptance. And I particularly have to think about that if, for example, the initial communication between the parties wasn't an advertisement. I have to worry about, is that an invitation to bid, or is that in fact an offer? What is an offer? I better have a working definition of an offer. Just in the same way as I have to have a working definition of each of these doctrines. And I take that working definition and I look at the language which might be an offer, although it might not be, it might be an invitation to bid, and I decide whether or not it's an offer or not. And what I'm principally looking for, of course, is it sufficiently detailed so that I can do two things. Number one is that if the person to whom it's directed simply said yes, a court would have something that it could call a contract. That is enough information about the responsibilities being undertaken by each side that you can identify, that you could determine whether or not there was performance or breach. Now, that's one thing I'm going to look at, but I'm also going to look at how wide is the audience to whom it's directed. Because as the audience is larger and larger, it becomes less and less likely that a court could say that it was an offer as opposed to an invitation to bid, because we would not have a mechanism for deciding who the offeree was if we have a bunch of people who are simultaneously, for example, saying yes. And we looked at those questions. That's the sort of specifics of what is an offer. Then we have to worry about how do offers die. Is the offer still available? If the person goes to accept, if the offeree goes to accept it, is it still alive? Did it die? Why does it die? It dies of old age. It dies because it's been rejected. It dies because there's a counteroffer, which extinguishes the power of acceptance. All those reasons why offers can die. You heard the offeree heard indirectly that the offeror was withdrawing the offer. We looked at all of those. And then if the offer is still there, if it's detailed enough, if it's finite enough with respect to who it's being to whom the offer is being made, then, and it's still available at the time that the offeree acts, then I have the question of, well, has there been an acceptance? And there we principally talked about the distinction. Acceptance is easy. They say yes. But the problem is if they say yes and or yes but, what have we got? And if the court thinks it's yes and, maybe the court will say, all right, well, there's a contract, but there's an acceptance, but there's a proposal to modify. If it says yes but, the court is probably going to say, uh-oh, that sounds as though it's a counteroffer. And then we have this awful ghost that lingers in our closet, namely, what if I say, well, gee, I'm really interested in that offer, but could you cut the price by 25%? And then I have to worry about, is the court going to say that that's a counteroffer? Is the court going to say it's a rejection of the offer? Is the court going to say, oh, it's just an inquiry, and the inquiry has no impact on the life of the offer? It remains alive. And we've seen that issue is not so easy to resolve. And in general, you have to be awfully careful about what you say if you want to keep the offer alive and you're saying anything other than yes. We have some problems about when the communication is not direct, and particularly we looked at some of the silly rules having to do with the use of the mails and the mailbox acceptance rule, and you need to have kind of a basic understanding not only of what the mailbox acceptance rule means, but how to avoid it. That is, if the offeror wants to avoid having the offeree able to create a contract without the offeror knowing about it, because it's deposited in the mail and becomes an effective acceptance upon deposit, then the trick is for the offeror to say that it's not an acceptance until I hear about it. And if the offeror does that, then that will be the binding rule, because overarching rule, overarching everything I've said is the offeror is the in control of the offer and is in control of the manner of the acceptance of the offer. Historically, the power of the offeree is simply to agree or not to agree. The shaping of the offer is the task, is within the power of the offeror. Then I have to move on and talk about consideration, of course, and decide whether or not there is consideration. I'm not going to do that this morning. Then we have to move on and talk about the statute of frauds. Does it fall within the critical any of the critical categories? For your purposes, the principal categories to worry about are contracts which cannot be performed within a year, and you remember the odd interpretation that's given that by the courts, and contracts which involve the sale of goods equal to a value of $500 or more, which under the Uniform Commercial Code at the moment have to be in writing. And there are some differences you need to know between the wording of the statute of frauds and the wording in the common law and the wording in the UCC. But the principal area of difference, the principal area of differences are twofold. Number one, the common law continues to have a somewhat more rigorous set of rules about how detailed the writing must be, though that's weakening over time. The UCC makes it perfectly clear that just so long as there's something in writing, even if it's inaccurate, and if there's something in the way of a signature, even if it just means letterhead, it's good enough. It's good enough to enforce it against the person. And the UCC adds this merchant provision, which is important, saying that between merchants, if you get an offer and you don't reject the offer, if you have an agreement, an alleged oral agreement, and you don't have the recipient of a copy of that agreement, which is sufficient under the common law, under the UCC, to enforce it against the sender, and you don't object to it. Now, you're not objecting to whether it's you're objecting to this as evidence of contract. You're objecting to that writing. If you don't do that in writing, then you're taken to have sufficiently entered into the agreement for the purpose of the UCC statute of frauds. Not true of common law. Common law, I get a letter from somebody saying, well, we have an agreement, and this was our agreement, and it's detailed, and it carries their signature, and I say absolutely nothing. I do not respond to that in any way, shape, or form. The statute of frauds remains a defense which I can offer, but remember, I must offer it as a part of my answer if there's litigation. I can't let it go beyond the stage of the answer. I can't answer it and then file a motion to dismiss on the ground that its statute of fraud says it's not enforceable. I must do it in writing, and that's true whether we're talking about the code or common law. The other difference between the UCC and common law that may be of some importance is that in the common law, the courts have increasingly said that if they find some performance, particularly some performance on both sides' part, of an agreement which should be in writing under the statute of frauds but is not, the court will go ahead and enforce it, saying that that part performance has taken it out of the limitations or rules of the statute of frauds. The UCC doesn't say no to that, but what it does say is that in the case of sale of goods, that the contract, despite the fact that there has been some payment made or some goods delivered, that the contract will not be enforced beyond the amount that has been paid or beyond the goods that have been delivered and accepted. so that you have some part performance doctrine to take cases outside of the statute of frauds in the UCC, but it is not as extensive as the doctrine of part performance is in some jurisdictions under the common law. All right, so now let's suppose that we know that we have offer and acceptance, we have consideration. If there is a requirement of writing under the statute of frauds, we have a writing that's adequate. And now we're at the next stage of the game, and the next stage of the game is going to be performance, breach, and excuse from performance. And that really occupied a substantial part of our time. And then, of course, at the end of the day, the last thing we have to reach is the subject of remedies in the event the court decides that there is a contract and there has been a breach. Well, what did we take up? One other thing. We're talking about what defenses can be uttered. And although we're going to talk about defenses which have to do with things which occur later under the law of impracticability, it is important to keep in mind that if your client is confronted with, or the client is confronting the other side with an argument there is a contract, and you've argued, look, I have all this evidence, we had this oral exchange, and we have this agreement, we have a writing if we had to, that there is more to that, what can I expect from the other side? Well, I can expect a number of attacks, even on the question of the enforceability of contract. And so one of the attacks I can expect is, oh yes, but we made a mistake. We made a mistake. So it looks as though we had mutual assent, but we really didn't. That's one kind of attack, and you're familiar with that attack. The other side may say, no, we didn't make a mistake, you made a mistake, in which case we have a different analysis because the protection available to the mistaken party, if it's a unilateral mistake, is not nearly as extensive as the protection available if you can show there's a mutual mistake. Mutual mistake, there's no contract. Unilateral mistake, well, the mistaken party may be able to get out of it if the court thinks that it was not the result of a, quote, neglect of duty, and if the other side is not relied. But if the other side is already relied or the court thinks there's been a neglect of duty, that unilateral mistake is meaningless in terms of legal significance and you won't get out from under. Mutual mistake, on the other hand, will result in a declaration that the contract was never really formed, even though it looks as though it's formed. Another possible hang-up, if you will, right at the outset is a disagreement about what the contract means. That is, they'll say, yes, you're saying that I didn't do X. Well, you're right, I didn't do X, but I didn't have to do X. Or I did do Y, but that's okay because I was supposed to. And the other side says, that's not what the contract says. And so there I am with a problem of interpretation, which the court is going to have to figure out, what is it that the contract, now that we say there is a contract, but what does it mean? What are the obligations of the parties, and how are we going to decide that? And if the contract's in writing, we're probably going to have a problem or a potential problem under the parole evidence rule. Because if it's in writing, one side may be arguing, yes, and I want to show you, Your Honor, what we really agreed to by introducing evidence of oral or written exchanges that occurred prior to the time we wrote the contract. And the other side's going to say, oh, blow the whistle, parole evidence rule, you can't do that. And what we've learned is that under modern law, what's going to happen is that the judge is going to listen to an offer of proof about what it is that you would be able to prove by bringing in this prior oral or written exchange. And if you can show that it, if one side can show that that would contradict the writing, then it's not going to be allowed. If, on the other hand, it does not contradict the writing, then we have another set of questions. We have to say, well, would persons naturally have omitted it? Is it understandable that they could have omitted it and yet still agreed to it at the point that they came to write it down? Or is this an instance in which when they wrote it down, they intended that to be the final, exhaustive, exclusive statement of the agreement of anything that they agreed to at all? And the code, at least, comes at this, the UCC comes at this with a kind of a bias toward deciding that parties generally are not writing the exclusive, exhaustive rendition of their agreement, but they could be. The onus will be on the parties seeking to prevent the introduction of that evidence to show that this was an instance in which we really intended this to be our final writing. Of course, they also argue at the outset that it contradicts what the writing says, because that will be the easier ground to win on. Common law, a little more evenly balanced on that question. In both instances, whether under the common law or under the UCC, the inclusion of a merger clause will be of assistance to the party arguing this was the exclusive statement of the parties, but it's not going to be universally persuasive. That is, the fact that it's there is not going to mean the court will conclude that it is an exclusive statement of the agreement of the parties. They may nevertheless go ahead and say, well, it says that, but, you know, these are just form agreements, and it's up to the court to decide whether it's the exhaustive, exclusive, final agreement of the parties in the writing. Anyway, that will be another. And third of all, there's the general interpretive issue. And we know that the courts will try and start from the writing of the parties, if there is one. They will go from there to looking at, they will listen to some evidence in case they find the language is ambiguous. They'll allow the introduction of some of the earlier negotiating history to decide whether or not there is or is not clarity provided by that earlier history and the way the parties use the words. And we know that they'll do that. We also know that they will look at prior performance of the parties under this agreement, if there is some, to see how that, what they can learn from that performance. And if there is no prior performance under this contract, but there is a past relationship between the parties in similar contracts with each other, then they'll look to see how the parties behaved under those. And finally, if the parties are members of a trade, of an identifiable trade, and that trade has a set of customs or rules, they will entertain those as a way of understanding what it is that the parties had agreed to. All of those. Now, once we get there, we now have an enforceable agreement, and we have an interpretation of that agreement. If we've gotten that far, then the next step is we're going to have to look at the question of the performance itself. And there there are lots of doctrines here. We identified some of the most important ones in contract law. One of them is that, starting out from a premise that parties were supposed to completely perform in order to enable, empower them to force the other side to perform, and you still see some remnant of that in the Uniform Commercial Code's perfect tender rule that the seller has to deliver goods that 100% perfectly conform to the contract. For the most part, our legal system has moved over to a standard of requirement that the party seeking to enforce the contract has substantially performed. Or, to put it the other way, they've not materially breached. If they substantially perform, the court will allow them to require the other party to perform or to pay damages, and they'll, of course, themselves be subject to a counterclaim to the extent that they have breached, which presumably is a minor breach rather than a major one, as the court has defined it. And so we will, you know, examine that question. In doing that, we'll also, before we even get there in a way, we'll look at another question, and that is, we'll say, well, let's see, is this really a promise that you made that you have substantially performed, or was it that a condition had to be fulfilled before the other side against whom you're trying to bring suit, that before that other side was obliged to act, that you had to satisfy a certain condition? If that was an express condition, then it had to be perfectly satisfied. And if it's not perfectly satisfied, then you can't sue the other side because the moment for their performance has not yet arrived because of the unsatisfied condition. Well, that requires, of course, another problem, another act of interpretation. Well, is it really an express condition, or is it really a promise? And you remember that that is to be distinguished from those arrangements which are really order of performance arrangements, which some people call implied conditions. That is, well, Your Honor, it's true that I could not demand that they pay me money for the goods until I deliver the goods. That is true. On the other hand, my delivery of the goods is not an express condition. Because it's not an express condition, I have the right to argue substantial performance. Now, with goods, you may or may not have that ability. Certainly with services, you certainly do have that ability. And so we've got to distinguish whether or not, we've got to identify whether there's an express condition, and if so, whether or not it's been satisfied. So that's another thing. Another thing that we're going to have, that issue that will be, I'm sure, argued in some appropriate cases is, well, yes, you're right, I had that, I made that agreement, and we did have an agreement, and you're right, I didn't perform it, and no, I don't have an excuse that there was no unsatisfied condition, but you know something? I didn't, because circumstances have changed dramatically so that a premise upon which our contract was based is no longer valid. It was valid when we made the contract, but it's not valid now. That, of course, is the law of impracticability or impossibility or frustration of purpose. And the side, one side is going to say, yes, that's true. The other side is going to say, no, that's not true. You can perform. Or, you're right, you can't perform, but you know something? When we made the contract, we allocated to you the risk that this kind of event might happen. We may not have written it down, we may not have said it, but we understood that the risk was allocated to you. And therefore, you cannot argue that you're excused by virtue of impossibility. Now, running throughout this, and I want to step back one step, because now I'm going to talk both about making a contract and I'm going to talk about performing the contract. And we can't leave this out, obviously. One of the pervasive notions of contemporary contract law is the notion of good faith. And we saw that good faith plays a very different role in whether or not the parties have come to the point of contract, a different role than it plays when we ask the question, okay, they have in fact made the contract, and now the question is, has there been a breach? The role of good faith is dramatically different. When it comes to making a contract, courts for the most part have said that you can't defraud the other side, you can't tell a lie, but on the other hand, even though you can't defraud them, you can certainly fail to communicate things that you know and you know that they don't know. You can do that. If you've led them into the error, no, you can't do that. So good faith has a very modest role to play, except in one area. And that's the area that has been identified by some courts in circumstances where the parties have negotiated for a long time, a big deal, and come to write a letter of intent. And they sign the letter of intent, but the letter of intent is not a contract itself, because the letter of intent says we've got these additional things that we have to decide upon. And some courts have said yes, but the fact that they've reached that point now creates an obligation to bargain in good faith, an obligation that otherwise we as members of our society do not have. That rule may change, but it's the rule now. However, once the contract is made, no court doubts that the parties have an obligation to perform in good faith. And that does impose the obligation to be cooperative in not only by performing yourself, but to cooperate in facilitating the performance by the other side of the performance that they've obligated themselves to do as part of their contract exchange. And we've been through that material, and you remember the Falstaff and case and the question of what it is that Falstaff had to do in order to comply with its bargain, with its obligation, implicit obligation of good faith in the distribution of Ballantine beer when the contract was made, to pay by volume, pay a royalty by volume rather than a royalty by percentage of profit. If, of course, we get that far and we decide that, in fact, there has been a breach of contract, then, of course, we turn to the next and last stage, which is decide what the remedy will be. And when it comes to remedies, we know that the preference for the common law is expectation, putting the aggrieved party in the position they would have been in had the contract been performed. And we also know that although the word expectation is not used in any of the specific formulas of Article 2, we know that it's part of the overall interpretive rule of Article 1, and that the formulas in Article 2 are, by and large, expectation-like formulas. That is, they seek to put the injured party in the position they would have been in had the contract been performed. They are, however, exact formulas, and we have to treat them as though they were part of the Internal Revenue Code and apply the formulas as they are given to us. If we're talking about remedies in the common law, you talk about expectation, and you know that lurking somewhere around sometimes is the doctrine of economic waste. It's not itself exactly an operative legal doctrine, but it's a principle that sometimes leads courts to use diminished value as the expectation measure instead of using cost of completion or cost of performance as the expectation measure. If what I've said sounds like Greek to you, that's because we studied in the fall term and you've forgotten about it, but you got to go back and study it again, enough so you feel you have the facility to work with it if the question I ask requires that you you provide some numbers. The only other subject I can think of that I haven't touched on at all that I should have somewhere back in that overly quick review was that although ordinarily breach is the non-performance of a task when performance is due under the contract, that's what ordinarily we mean by breach. The breach can occur through a process referred to as repudiation, which is to say that it can happen in advance of the time for performance. And we've looked at repudiation as it is, anticipatory repudiation or repudiation as a doctrine of common law, and we looked at repudiation as a matter of the way in which the UCC handles it. We saw that the UCC added a device which may be useful in this practical circumstance, that is the ability to make a written demand for assurance of performance. If it's not forthcoming, then that will be treated as an anticipatory repudiation. And we saw some of the risks involved in moving through the process of being the aggrieved party, having received a repudiation, and trying to figure out what to do. Shall I act now? Shall I go ahead and cover? Or shall I go ahead and make a substitute contract? Or shall I go ahead and resell? Or can I wait for performance? Or shall I urge performance? But if I urge performance, can I then go ahead and resell or go ahead and cover, depending upon whether they're a seller or a buyer or not?